Welcome to Take It From Us with host Kent Johns. Real people, real voices, real lives, discussing mental health, addiction, and disability in the community. Your weekly window to the real world. Welcome to Take It From Us.
Take It From Us. Hope you've had a great week. Welcome into our program again, Mental Health Awareness Week. Yeah. And I remember talking to Jimmy Hunt about mental fitness many, many months ago on our program. And he made a very good point that most people now know are aware that we have a mental health crisis in New Zealand. So it's not so much about awareness now, it's about action. So Mental Health Awareness Week, for me, is a really good opportunity to sit back and think, okay, what action can I take to best look after myself and therefore then be in a stronger position to help others? And I was at a Future of Medicine conference over the weekend, big focus there on what we can all do to improve the health system. But the message really, the take-home message for me was that health and well-being starts at home. And we were all challenged to think more about what we can do to help ourselves. There's plenty we can do for our mental fitness, just being at home. Exercise is the most powerful. The research around that is quite overwhelming now. Exercise is the most powerful thing you can do to manage your own mental well-being at home. But there are other levers that we can pull as well. So I am going to try, wait for this, hot therapy. And this is from someone who struggles in the heat. I really don't enjoy the heat too much. I like when I'm warm, and I do like summer. I don't mind being hot, but I also like to cool off pretty damn quick, let me tell you. But I know the benefits of sauna are known to be tremendous. The benefits around sauna are just huge. So my personal commitment is, yeah, I'm going to give this a crack. I'm going to find a sauna, and I'm going to commit to going. And then if I get too hot, I can just go and jump in the ocean. That's the plan. So this is Mental Health Awareness Week. For me, it's Mental Health Action Week, or Mental Fitness Action Week. And that is the action that I will take. And I will persevere and probably perspire as well. Our first guest today is Beeks James. She's just launched a book about living with bipolar disorder. The book has many other contributors. Beeks, it's nice to have you on Take It From Us and to hear about your life and those of others living with bipolar. How are you?
I'm green, thanks very much. Yeah, bit of a whoopsie night last night and the book coming out this morning. It's just divine. Thank you. Yeah.
So grand, whoopsie, and divine. I think those are the first that's the first time we've heard any of those adjectives on this program.
What about groovy? Groovy? That's pretty
good. Yeah, groovy's a good one. Someone said to me the other day, spunky, and I hadn't heard that phrase for years.
Me neither. Wow. It's supposed to be good looking, right? Oh, they're spunky.
Well, it was when I was 12 or 13. That was the key phrase, yeah. So a lot happening. You've got the book coming out, Polar Opposites. How did the book come about? Tell us about that.
Okay, so I had wanted for a long time to write about my story, and then a friend of mine in the UK who does a lot of self-publishing said, look, I want you to be an author in my book. So I wrote my story, put it in her book, and then I'm part of there's a company called Landmark Training Development, Landmark Worldwide, and I do a lot of their personal development courses. And one of those courses I'm a head coach on at the moment. We all participants and all coaches and all program leaders do a project, take on a project. So that's where this came from. And, you know, bipolar was at my heart. It's something I'd want to do for a while. And so I took it on.
You took it on, and not only that, but it's your story as well as how many others?
There's eight authors altogether. Yeah.
And when you looked at their stories and compared them to your own, how similar or dissimilar are they?
So, Kent, so different. Right. So different in so many ways. There are so many versions of, if you like, I don't like to put it as a version, of bipolar. It's unreal. You know, there's real extremes of people that have gone through all sorts of things, like thinking that they're Jesus. You know, that's a or throwing Coke cans at planes. That wasn't in our book, but I know of people that that's what they do. And I'm kind of one of the more milder versions. I would just be extremely high and silly. And when I was low, I didn't want to live, you know, so I was suicidal. Never did anything anywhere near close to wanting to do that, but I thought about it, you know. So, yeah, loads of different versions, Kent. I could give you a million, you know.
And for you, tell us about the difference in your nature when you're either up high or down low.
Okay, so when I was low, completely debilitated, I couldn't put two words together. I couldn't communicate with my best friend. I couldn't communicate with my dad. I couldn't communicate with anyone. And I would hide myself away. I'd still go about I was unemployed probably for most of the 8 years because I couldn't hold myself in a job. What occurred to me is my normal self, my happy self, was a, you know, an unnatural high, and I would just be probably very immature sometimes, very silly. It was kind of in my nature anyway to try and make people laugh, and it was, you know, it wasn't natural making people laugh. It was, there was at a cost, you know. And I just could talk to anyone, Ken, you know, like at the time when I was in my highs, I remember saying I could talk to the Prime Minister right now and it would be no problem, you know. Just over exuberance in terms of your confidence. But I thought that was just me back, you know, my normal self back. But I was a world beater, you know.
Right.
That's the difference.
Okay. So when you're in that high state, you're thinking that's, for want of a better word, your normal self. So is there almost a lack of self-awareness that actually you're riding this enormous high and that eventually it will come crashing down?
Yeah, and you don't think it's going to happen again. So the illness is so designed, if you like, you know, that you think once you come good, you're always going to be good, no matter how many times it's happened. And you think you're going to continue to be bad and low and depressed and suicidal forever, even though you know you've had your high times. But I didn't know all that. I had not one doctor, Kent, said to me, "Oh, that sounds to me, you know, that's bipolar." No one during those years until the very final time when I said we'd see another doctor. So I didn't know the difference.
what did the other specialists think that they were treating at the time then?
You know what? Just major depression. And I don't put that lightly, just major depression, but that's what they were treating me for. They give me antidepressants and I stopped taking them because they just served to make me really lethargic. They said to me, okay, what about, you know, going to see a psychologist? So I said for sort of 2 or 3 years on the trip, I would go to see the same psychologist with my sister. It was incredible, by the way, my sister. And each time she'd be, you know, it was 30 years ago, Ken, but what I do remember is I'd be low as, and then suddenly after so many months I would come good, and we thought that she'd done a lot of good, started looking into my family, started looking into, you know, things I decided about myself many years ago, and it, you know, unbeknown to us, it was going to make no difference. And that was while not being on any drugs whatsoever for depression. So I'm doing a lot of talking here, Kent, but the stats say that over a fifth of people that are, you know, that are bipolar and don't know it get diagnosed as major depressive, because we don't talk about the highs as if they're highs. We talk about them as they're, oh, I'm happy now, you know. So it's really hard for, I would say, a challenge for doctors to actually diagnose you. So it goes unbeknown for many years. Mm.
And so how dangerous are the highs?
My highs aren't. Mine are at the, I did, and you see it in my, I had someone write a story about me in the book. So my ex-partner from years ago and best friend from years ago, she spoke to a few other people about me and a friend of mine when we were going through Europe. We were on an East German border, and this is the worst I could probably ever do. we were on the East German border when it was definitely communist, right? And we were trying to get our things together and get our books together and stuff in order to, you know, our documents to get across into Berlin. And I turn around after the guards are just starting to walk away, and I did that Sieg Heil salute. Now, it could have been real dangerous because it didn't take much in those days to, you know, for them to take umbrance to something like that. It could have been dangerous for all of us. So, and I had no control over it. It's what I would do. So dumb. But I didn't, you know, I kind of didn't know. That's the worst. For me, that's the worst. I could tell you a whole heap of things about people that were in highs and lows and did some really dangerous things. I don't know if you want to hear those, but yeah.
But you're not aware of the potential danger or the potential risk, because it sounds like you are bulletproof at that time.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, you just do inappropriate things. I used to do personally inappropriate things. I went to a group after going to my psychiatrist and I was diagnosed and I got on the pills, and he said, please go to a group at Wellington Hospital, because I was living in New Zealand at that point. And I went in and there was like 20 people in there in that group talking about what had gone on, and I was the only one out of 20 people that hadn't been hospitalised at least once, and I never had been hospitalised. And one guy spoke about during the Gulf War in the 90s, he went out to Wellington Airport and started throwing Coke cans at planes on the runway. So that gives you a little bit of an idea, hey? And another bank manager at the time in Wellington who was holding down his job and was soliciting himself on Vivian Street with, you know, because bulletproof, because of whatever was going on for him, you know. Yeah. These are my stories.
Yeah, so you really need help or specialised assistance to figure out that the perceived normal is not that these highs are related to bipolar disorder.
Yeah, yeah. That illness in particular, absolutely related to. I don't have the expertise to know if it happens in other mental illnesses, but certainly in this one, this is what happens. These are a smattering of examples that I heard and read about, you know.
Mm. And what changed for you with the diagnosis?
Everything. Yeah. I got my life back.
Tell us more about that.
Yeah. So this was when I was in 1991 or 1990. And my big love was football, soccer, and I'd always wanted to make the New Zealand team and never made it, always got close. And then, of course, it was mainly during the winters, and it wasn't related to the winter stuff, but I would get my cycles would be during my football season, I would be low. And so, you know, friends of mine, teammates would speak about me having amazing games and then just rubbish ones. And of course you couldn't be like that at New Zealand level. And so when I came good, you know, just so happened with my pills, etc., I made the New Zealand team, women's football team, the Football Ferns, to go to qualify in Australia for the first ever Women's World Cup. So that's what it provided for me, Kent, because I probably still gave myself a hard time on the pitch, but it wasn't the same level, you know. I didn't need a high to perform well.
And what was the treatment that you were receiving, or what sort of help and assistance did you have?
Okay, so it was purely lithium carbonate, which is what I was prescribed, which is a chemical imbalance in your brain. And the lithium, they don't even know why it ever worked, but they discovered in research that it worked. And I came good and I knew I'd come good forever as it, you know, perceived at the time, because it was the first time I'd ever been in a depression for less than 6 months. It lasted that particular depression before I started taking the pills had probably been going for about 2 months. And then I came good. And so I knew it was the pills. And I turned to my mum. I was on holiday in, with mum and dad in Taupo, my hometown. And I just turned to mum on the beach in Lake Taupo and said, "Mum, this is it. I'm good. This is it. This is, I'm well again, and I'm going to be well, you know." So, yeah, lithium carbonate. And that's just me personally. People pick a lot of things, and I don't profess to know what all those medications are, Kent, but other things suit other people, yeah.
And how would you describe your life then in the last 30, what would that be, 32 years?
Really? Older? No. How would I describe? Do you know what? Just normal me with ups and downs that the normal human being would get. I don't like to say normal, but like, I have times just like anyone does, and I have great times like other people have. It's just not unnatural anymore. And certainly since the late 90s with the Landmark Forum first and the rest of the courses, I've come to know myself a whole heap better and know what makes me tick. And I'm not a world beater, but anything's possible with me. I'm at the moment I'm training to be a program leader with Landmark. And it's very, very exciting because this work, you know, provides so much for everyone. And I recommend anyone do Landmark Forum. And I don't get paid to say that, by the way.
Sure. And do you ever offer advice to people who do have bipolar disorder to talk about it and to encourage them to, I guess, articulate how they're going to others to help us understand?
Yeah. Not constantly, but I do a lot. There's been people, certainly in the UK, I lived there for 25 years, and my partner at the time just asked me to speak to someone that was ill and was supposed to be going to a psychiatrist, was mentally ill. And we sat down, I didn't know from a bar of soap, and we sat down and I asked her to describe what had gone on. And I said, "Look, I'm not a medical professional, but my recommendation is you go and see a psychiatrist because you can only, and you have to do it via your doctor to go to a psychiatrist. You can only get drugs for this particular illness if you go to go to your doctor and then get prescribed a psychiatrist." So I encouraged her then to go and see a psychiatrist. She did that and was well, you know. And I speak about it all the time. I don't hide at all. You know, it's who I am. It's not, bipolar didn't make me who I am. I decided that a long time ago as to who I am in the world. But I want to make a difference to people in the world. I want them to know that all they've got to do is see a psychiatrist to find out what it is that's going on for them. It might be another mental illness, but just to get to know, you know, so that if it is bipolar, they can be prescribed the necessary pills. It's clinical. There's nothing they can do about it other than, you know, get prescribed medication. Yeah. And there's lots of things I would recommend in terms of, you know, your mental health. But again, I'm not a medical professional. But yeah, just get a diagnosis, whatever that is, get a diagnosis.
We're with Beaks James on Take It From Us. And we're talking about her new book that she's collaborated on with 8 other authors called Polar Opposites. What else is, what you talked about then other things. What else has worked for you besides the medication?
The medication? I already mentioned Landmark because that's like the courses.
But as far as your lifestyle goes, what?
Yeah, my lifestyle. Being great to myself, saying great things to myself, creating myself newly every day with a possibility. Going, you know, speaking to my coach. being open, you know, being open about this. being self-expressed about it, you know, not being embarrassed about it. Geez, I've never even thought about these sorts of things before, Kent, but yeah, not being embarrassed about it, you know, sharing with people, because there's a different listening for mental illness in this day and age. It used to be that it was a bad listening for it and you'd get put away, you know?
Sure. Well, you'd like to think we've come a long way. I mean, we still have a long way to go, obviously, but we have we have come a long way. And I'm fascinated to know as to the people in the, and your sister and those closest to you trying to work out what was going on in your life. Then you get the diagnosis and you're able to better explain to them what you're able to talk about and what's how have they been towards you since that? What's the difference been?
The difference? Their lives are purely easier now because they don't have to deal with me coming to them when I was low, because that's the only time I want to see them. I wouldn't want to see them any other time. So their lives are a whole heap more enriched as a result of it. They have great lives anyway. And they don't need to be responsible for me anymore. And I think that would have been something I would have been the same if my sister or brother had been that way, had been ill. I would have had the occurring that it was my responsibility to get them well, and that yeah, they don't have to worry about me anymore, Kent. That's the thing.
It must have been revelatory for them.
Yeah, major. And of course, we've been talking a lot more about it since the creating the book. But, you know, they've been telling me bits and pieces that they've never told me before. That's the thing. It's opened up major stuff that they've kind of forgotten about and have now been able to speak about it more readily. And friends as well. This person that wrote on behalf of me went to a lot of people to get stories. And so it started everyone speaking about it. So their lives are more enriched. I'm not saying that their lives would have been awful because I was low and depressed. Or high, or whatever it was, but it's enriched their lives. I'm sure it's had them not have to feel responsible for me, and I'm speaking for people right now.
Yeah, I can imagine it's been a cathartic experience for everybody to get these thoughts down and to get them published.
Yeah, for sure. Certainly for the authors, like, you know, I don't know half of them. You know, there's a few that I know. There's a few people that I know a lot better now, but haven't even met yet. You know, that have written. Because I got out there on Facebook and said, this is what I'm doing. It was the best way to do it. And, you know, because there were friends of friends, there's people in the book. There's one person I'm coaching with was her. I had two authors come from her half-sister and her half-sister's mother, both there. So it was my self-expression out in the world and on platforms that had people that able to, you know, speak about this and have this cathartic experience and get them speaking with their families and friends probably more as a result of it. Yeah.
And what's been the most rewarding part of writing the book, Beaks?
Making a difference. It sounds really corny, but making a difference to people, allowing them to express, you know, it's actually in the last 24 hours, there's so many people that have been coming up on my Facebook, other people's Facebooks, people I don't even know, saying, hi, that's my sister or that's my brother or, keep it going, this is awesome. And our book sales have gone, our Kindle sales rather, have gone through the roof because it's only available on Kindle at the moment. And so we're number one in Australia in our categories. You choose categories. I don't know if you know much about this, but you choose categories. We chose coping with bipolar and a couple of others, and we're number one. We've actually sealed number one in Australia for both of those categories. And we're very close in the UK at the moment. So anyone listening, please just go and get the Kindle, put a review on. It makes it even better. Sorry, Kent, sometimes I'm forgetting what you've asked.
No, you've answered it really well. The most rewarding part of the book is making a difference for you by getting to so many people, which it sounds like you've been able to do, you must be making a difference.
Yeah, for sure. You know, comments we're getting from people is just unreal. And, oh, we're going to go and buy that now. We're going to do that. And our interviews that we had last night went out live, and we've got to put those all on our Facebooks, but we had loads of people listening to those. So you, it's getting to the people you're never going to know, Ken, that you got to, that then got to their people, that got to them people, that got to their people. So that's the most rewarding thing, is that we're saving lives. Have I said to you about the suicides in New Zealand, hey? Have I shared that?
Did you want to share some stats with us?
Yeah. So a quarter of completed suicides in New Zealand are associated with, suicides are associated with bipolar. So that's quite a phenomenal amount. And they're saying maybe, you know, so it's actually, the stats say maybe related to bipolar people, or by people that have been affected by bipolar. And I think I said to you before that that a fifth of people with bipolar that are undiagnosed a fifth of people that have been gone to talk, speak to people or doctors about their depressions have been diagnosed as major depressive. So it doesn't get picked up. And so that's why it takes so many years to be, you know, diagnosed and get people on pills and get them happy. And that's why we lose so many people in the meantime. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. So there's an onus really on all of us to help those that are having the highs and the lows to get diagnosed. Is it as easy as saying that or not?
No, it's not as easy as that, because people are in denial as well. People that are ill are in denial. I mean, I almost didn't go to my sister-in-law's doctor because I'd tried everything, and you get really, you know, you're so low, you start shutting off to stuff. So it does take something for a family member to, you know, listen, to actually broach the subject and say, hey, I've heard about this, and I've heard this on radio, and I've heard it in this book. What do you reckon is the similar to yours? And they're like, you know, it's a hard pill to swallow, you know, that's not me. It's not me. And, fortunately I took the advice, but not everybody does. So it's sometimes it's getting out on the skinny branches with your people and saying, no, we're going. Right now, you know, actually putting up with what you might get as a result of, you know, upset from your loved one, just so that you get them where they need to be, you know, gotten. And, you know, it's tough and challenging on those loved ones, but in most cases, the people that get diagnosed have had support from a loved one or a family member, a friend. So it doesn't often come from the person themselves. I haven't got stats for that, by the way. I have nothing to back it up except from speaking to people.
The book is called Polar Opposites.
Yep.
Beaks, it's been great having you on the program. I really value having this conversation with you. It sounds like people are loving the thought of reading this, and I wish you all the very best with it.
Well, thank you so much, Ken. The actual name of the book, because Polar Opposites is actually a movie, a children's movie, but Polar Opposites, Bipolar, Broken Through is what it's called, and you can get it on Amazon. Yeah, just... put it on Amazon, go and get it, and get everybody in your family to buy it too. I think it's about $7, $8 New Zealand dollars. And we're taking the world by storm. We're going to get this everywhere.
You're making the difference, Beaks.
Thank you for you. Thank you for you and this radio station. And, you know, one of our authors told me about this. So, you know, don't stop talking about it, please.
We won't, I promise. And thanks for coming on.
Not at all, Kent. You've been wonderful. Thanks so much.
Conscience show.
From us, our next guest on the program is Caroline Westerlin-Wilson. She's the Managing Director of AOKNZ. Caroline, thanks for agreeing to have a chat with us today about the work that you're doing around suicide prevention, the education and the awareness, and also about the wellness and mental distress courses you run. Really appreciate your time.
Awesome. Really appreciate the opportunity to connect this afternoon.
Yes, and isn't connection great? We need it. We need probably more of it, don't we?
Yeah, we do need a lot more, you know, off the screen like this, face to face.
Yeah.
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 I need more of that.
Yeah, I find that a lot of people think they're connected when they're using Facebook or they're using WhatsApp or whatever it might be, but you spend too much time with that stuff and you don't actually spend enough time around other people.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, when we're looking at well-being and people, I mean, we're from a whole order well-being perspective, like we have all sorts of senses that need to be connected, not just the eyes and the ears and ears. There's all the other stuff, you know, the emotive, the intuition, the physical, all of that stuff. You can't do online, you can only do face-to-face. And so we're only kind of using a very limited part of us when we're doing this. And if we don't move into the face-to-face physical contact, we won't be exercising some of those other sensories, and that's kind of dangerous if we don't really think about that.
Is that something that you talk to people about regularly?
Well, we sit on the suicide prevention end. And so, unfortunately, we're sitting on the end when all else has failed and a person is now looking at very little or very last resort almost. And when a person's at last resort, you know, every ounce of them is communicating that. And so we're teaching people in the physical context, are you able to pick those signs up? From an audio context, are you able to pick that up? From the screen-to-screen context, are you able to pick some of that up? But like I said earlier, you know, we have all these sensories that some of these mediums limit some of that, and so you may not always pick it up when people are at their last resorts, which unfortunately for some is suicide.
Yeah. And what have you noticed about how we're all going sort of recently, particularly getting through winter?
I mean, we're post-COVID, post-mandate, post-lockdown.
Yay!
Post-cyclone. There's so much going on right now that people are kind of almost at that, they're not at last resort, but they're starting to kind of ask themselves, where else can I get a top up on my reserves? Because my reserves are running quite low. People are in a state of trying to refurbish or trying to redefine, trying to move forward. And it's hard because you can't just, you need conditions to be able to move forward. Some people can press on based on their resilience levels and supports that they have. For people who don't have all of that, you can imagine how hard it's going to be for them. And so you're using a lot more to move forward in this current climate as opposed to pre-lockdown and all of that. And so, and then we've got cyclones and I don't know. I think sometimes maybe screen to screen is good because you're not picking up on all of that stuff in the physical realm. And you may miss some of that. But when you're sitting with people and you're engaging with them, you can pick that stuff up. You can pick up that people are on edge. People are overloaded. They're carrying more than they can. The reserves are low in terms of energy, resources. And as you look around New Zealand, some of our services right now are just absolutely overloaded. So when they need help, where do they go? You know, they turn to their whānau and everyone else is on low reserve or just coping with, just having enough capacity for themselves that people then, you know, we're kind of just looking around going, where do we go? And this is where resilience really comes in. But what is resilience?
Yeah. Or even anti-fragility, which goes beyond resilience. And the principle of anti-fragility is that we actually can go through stressful times and come out stronger or be wiser or whatever it might be, whereas resilience gets us back to baseline. So that kind of fascinates me. But I think you touched on something really powerful then, which is at the moment, so many of us are just struggling to cope with overwhelm and worry and fear and anxiety that when someone else comes to us, hey, do you just have some time? I want to have a chat, or they want to offload, or they want to unburden. Yeah. It can be really challenging to be truly empathetic and present with them because, like you mentioned, our reserves are so low.
Yeah. I mean, you've highlighted all those life demands that are sort of going above what we normally would manage. And then you've got our reserves that are constantly on the decrease because we're using it. And so if you're not topping it up, you're just either just managing or you're just kind of going, I hope tomorrow I might, you know, get some more reserve to be able to manage what I couldn't manage today. And so you're quite right. If people are just barely holding on to themselves, how are they able to offer extra support to others? But we can see this in our mental health services and our health systems that some of those waiting times are up to, I mean, some of those, on average, some of those waiting times are months now, at the max end, 18 months. And people are now having to just say, no, we just don't have the capacity. We just don't have the capacity. And so we really have to change some of our conversation around some of what you've just highlighted there, some of that, you know, how do we come back to the individual and connect them with their own home order, with their own well-being needs, and be able to sort of recognize which part of me right now isn't holding up. What do I need to do because we can't, you know, we've built this culture of help a mate, talk to a mate, but if you're not looking after yourself, what good are you? What good are you?
Yeah, I mentioned this. It feels like it's a tireless message that I try and get out there with my role, in that if you are too busy to make time for self-care, what the hell's the point?
Yeah.
But what are we doing? Like I say we, because I've been guilty of this too, Caroline. Like, collectively, what are we doing that in our community we take so little time for ourselves?
Yeah. I don't think there's a lot of talk around a community approach. I get that, but we need to come back to what can we do? And I know there's controversy around that. It's an individualistic approach, but some of us have to take responsibility and ownership around our own well-being. And until we actually look inwards, how good are we to then offer that to someone else? Like, you know, and it's never going to be good enough as well, because you're not looking after yourself. And there's a drain. Like, and we don't talk about that because we're all altruistic people. We want to be good people. You know, we want to love on each other. But that takes from you. That takes from you to offer or top someone else up.
Yeah.
So when you take some of your reserve to help someone else, well, we've got to recognize that and have some things in place to be able to top that up immediately. But we don't have proper conversations around that. We don't talk about emotions enough. We don't understand the importance of expressing emotions. And unfortunately, a lot of our kōrero or conversations around emotion sort of sits around five, which is anger, happiness, sadness, depression, anxiety. And if you look into the language of emotions, there's about 170. And so if we're feeling things and all we have is a vocab of five words and you get it wrong, then you're managing the wrong thing. And so if people aren't aware of other kinds of emotions that sit there, we might mistaken it for depression, and then we're going to the doctors and saying, I'm feeling depressed. Doctor then treats the depression and it might be something totally different. And so we really need to, it's not one thing, eh? It's not one thing. There's a whole heap of things that people need to be educated around, informed about. There needs to be a toolkit that people need to have for themselves, just so that, one, they can recognize their own, and I say distress signals, because some of that stress is good for us, but we all have a threshold. And it's important that people know what their threshold is, because we have limits, we're bloody human. They need to know, recognize, what are those signals when we're hitting the threshold? What are those signals? And they're all individualistic. You know, I'm Samoan. You don't look Samoan. What are you?
I'm not. I'm a New Zealand European. You might not believe that.
But a lot of our stuff, you know, around mental health is sometimes even done in a cultural context. And as a Samoan, and I might get shot for this, but as a Samoan, not all Samoans feel the same things.
Sure.
We don't all have the same stresses. And so we have to bring it back to people knowing who they are, people knowing what their relationship with distress is, being able to recognize their signals, but also knowing, you know, having a toolkit ready to be able to respond to that, whether they're coping activities, whether they're being able to kōrero with someone, whether it's an exercise, whether it's a resource or a service, whatever, people need to have those conversations with themselves earlier on rather than at the edge.
Yeah, we're having a conversation on Take It From Us with Caroline Westerlin-Wilson, who's the Managing Director of AOKNZ. A/OK stands for Acts of Kindness.
Yeah.
I like that. Tell us how that came to be.
Well, that came to be because... when we initially set this up, we called it AOK Suicide Prevention Training Education. And people just freaked out. People absolutely freak out when you use the word suicide or distress. And so we were like, shit, you know, we need, I'm sorry, you know, I swear, take that back. But people need to, people often think when you hear words like suicide, only clinicians or trained and qualified people can have these conversations. The reality is, when a person's in that place, they're at their lowest and they're needing anything to come back up a little bit or just have a bit of a top up in their reserves. And all it requires quite often is an act of kindness or some kind of kindness action. And the other thing is a lot of people are thinking, oh, what do I don't want to say the wrong thing. I don't want to say the wrong thing. In fact, it's more the intention that's sitting behind what people do and say that people who are in a place of distress pick up on. And if there's kindness sitting behind that, that's what quite often helps people rather than saying the right thing. And so for us, that is the, I guess, the fundamental of a lot of the skills that we talk and offer. It has to have that intention.
So we're better off to lean in and say something clumsy and the person know that we're there for them than to do nothing.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I know there are some things you just should not say at all. Yep. And I grew up on some of those messages. I grew up on some pretty horrific messages. And I'm not promoting those messages, but what I did feel in those horrific messages was there was love, there was fear, there was, you know, them running out of things to say. And this is you as a teenager. And sometimes we can pick the aroha or the manakitanga that sits behind a lot of the wrong things. And so rather than be hard on people and say, you shouldn't say that, you shouldn't say this. In fact, if we say nothing, which is worse?
Yeah.
Which is worse, saying the wrong thing or saying nothing at all?
Saying nothing often doesn't help anyone. And then you feel guilty about saying nothing.
Oh, absolutely. You feel guilty about saying nothing. And, you know, one of the funniest things about what you're highlighting right now is when a person's in distress, the very dilemmas that stop them from asking someone for help is the same dilemmas a helper has that stops them offering the help. And so the very things that they're wondering, oh, I don't want to, if I ask, I'm going to be shamed, I'm going to look weak, I don't know what to say, you know, I don't want to be rejected. The person who's helping has the same dilemmas. I don't know what to say, I don't want to be rejected, I don't want to make it worse. And so because of these dilemmas, unfortunately, people subtly talk themselves out of doing anything, and which is why we end up with nothing being done.
Mm. So tell us about the work that you're doing with suicide prevention.
So in the suicide prevention space, we work with a lot of, we work along the suicide prevention spectrum. We, over the 15 years that I've been in the space, we recognise that people have different helping capacity, meaning there's some people that just don't want to help, but they might want to go and alert the helper, meaning they don't want to get into that space because it's too confronting for them. However, they just want to know who are the helpers. And then there's some people that are like, I just want to start the conversation and then know who to hand it over to. And then other people are like, I want to do the full works. And then other people are like, because of my, because I've lost someone to suicide, I understand what that grief process is. So I want to help out on that end. So the faces I've just highlighted, the different programs that we offer, but the goal here is to be able to build a life-supporting community where everyone has a helper role, regardless of the levels of capacity. Even if you're not getting into that space, your job might be just to go and alert the helpers, knock on their door and say, hey, connector, we need you over here. If it needs to be escalated, the same person might run over and grab the safety aider. And so it really is about a community coming together and knowing what their capacity is and how they can help that one person that might be in that space just looking for some extra support.
And the people that are at the edge of the cliff that you talk about, have they in most cases exhausted all options, or is it that they haven't looked in certain directions for help because they're not sure that it's there or they're not sure how to ask for that help?
All of the above. And when a person can't see any other options in their mind, their perception is they have exhausted all options. And when people are in that place of distress, as you know, their view becomes quite, very narrow. And they don't see what was working maybe a day ago. because all they're seeing right now is the problem, and the problem or the distress now manifesting on their body. And now they're just trying to figure out, how do I release, you know, the stress that's sitting on my neck, or how do I release the pain that's sitting on my back? And so the distractions around the distress take them off on a totally different tangent, which in their mind feels like there is no help, there is no one, because they just can't see any of that. And, you know, quite often there used to be a campaign years ago that used to say, that used to talk about choosing life when you're in that place. And you've got to really ask yourself, can a person really choose life when they're in that space? You know, or is it that suicide is the only option for them? And what we also know is that when people look at suicide, they're not even seeing it as death. They're seeing it as they're seeing suicide or the activity that has a suicide outcome, they're seeing it as a release or a relief or a solution or an end to the chaos. Not very many people see that the activity that they're thinking of actually ends in death. Mm. That's the scariest bit. And that's why these conversations need to be, we need to have these conversations, because if people don't talk to those distresses or to the activity that they're thinking about, they don't actually realize, damn, that's actually going to end my life. What?
Yeah.
What?
And most people who, I'm trying to make sure I get the language correct here, most people who try and kill themselves actually don't. And we think it's because people don't actually want to die. They just want the pain to end because the helplessness and the hopelessness has become too much. And I wonder if people could actually stop themselves and actually ask themselves that question in the moment, which is, God, it's easier said than done, I guess, when you're so desperate, but this is final for me. I'm checking out. I'm dead.
Yeah.
Whether that would be strong enough to help.
I think for most people, if they were given the opportunity and the space to talk to the intentions around, you know, what the purpose of their activity is, if they realize that death was the outcome, most people may not go through with it. That would freak them out enough to maybe, and I always talk about knee-jerking that little bit of life to their view. They might actually realize that's not what I want to do. There are some people that do choose, very few though. I just want to give some portion around this, or just some just a view around this. There are a very small amount of people that are just, that's what I want to do, and don't stop me. But the thing is this, if they really wanted to do it, it would have been done. And the fact that they're still alive tells us we still have a chance. There's still a chance for us to help them. Maybe even question why they're still here, and maybe even identify that there is a little part of their subconscious that's keeping them here. And giving them a bit of time to think about that might allow them to give some life reasons to why they are still here and they haven't gone through with it.
So, Caroline, how did you come to be in the position that you're in, working for Acts of Kindness and helping people stay alive and hopefully stay safe and mentally well?
I mean, my whānau have lost a family member to suicide, 20 years this year, actually, this month, which is a little bit confronting because it's the, you know, every month the weather happens the same way. We have the grey skies, the heavy rains, and it almost feels like we're replaying this year again and again. And so, you know, my whānau member who had taken their own life, he was a real advocate for life and just despised suicide. And so for us, it was a total shock that he ended up taking his own life because it wasn't a value that, you know, our whānau was brought up on. And a total shock to the system. And it highlighted so many things, like could we have helped? Would he have spoken to us? Like even people who have these kind of values, you know, we've learned could also find themselves in this space. But one of the biggest things that I learned was the devastation that the wider whānau and the wider his friend circles, you know, the devastation they had, not so much around the fact that he had died by suicide, but by the fact that they weren't called in to help. And so that's something we have to live with as a family, that we didn't ask people for help because we didn't know that we could. You know, we don't know if we, this was a small problem, whether we need to keep it secret. And so the learning has been massive. And so part of why I guess I do what I do is to be able to encourage conversation, to be able to encourage whānau connection, to involve as many people as possible. Because most people, when you have learnt that someone's died by suicide, you always ask these two questions. One, why? You know, why would someone be in that sort of place? And the second question we all ask is, could I have helped? Could I have done anything? Which tells me most people, I'd say the majority of our communities, would want to help if they knew who that person was. So part of my mahi is, how do we help people have some level of skill to be able to either help directly or run around and get the help that the person needs?
One final question, Caroline, before I let you go. You've talked a lot about the mental wellbeing system that we have in New Zealand and the work that we need to do both individually and collectively as a society. If you could change, if you could wave a magic wand and change one thing, what would it be?
I'd make all these programs mandatory. whether you think you're ready for them or not, it's a life skill. It's a life skill. I mean, we learn how to do CPR, we learn how to do first aid. This is another version of that. Like physical first aid, suicide kills. And I think if we could make these programs mandatory and relevant to the various places in our society, I think we'd have a lot more help on board, a lot more help on the ground.
You can have a look at the website, a/oknz.com. That's a/oknz.com. Caroline, you do amazing work. Thank you so much for coming on the program. I know that there's some real passion there, and it's really needed, probably more so than ever. So thank you so much for joining us today.
I appreciate you, Kent. Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity.
Caroline Westerlin-Wilson on Take It From Us, doing some great stuff, really interesting conversation. Also, thanks to Beaks James for being on our program today as well, just showing some courage to be open to talk about her struggles over the years, but now she's able to help, and we wish her all the very best with that brand new book. By the way, for Mental Health Awareness Week, more information, there's a website, mhaw.nz, mhaw.nz. To get in touch with us, of course, you can jump on Facebook or you can get to our own website, tifuradio.org. Leave a note, tell us about things that are happening in your part of New Zealand, Aotearoa, in our community, something that we haven't touched on yet, or perhaps you just want to tell us about your story. Please do that, tifradio.org. Big thanks to Karen Murphy, who's put the program together as always. I really hope you look after yourselves and each other this week. And if you can find one thing to lean into to better help your own mental well-being, go for it. Good luck with it. And if you want, you can let us know. We'd love to hear from you. Have a great week. We'll talk again soon.
You've been listening to Take It From Us with host Kent Johns, produced by Karen Murphy, executive producer Andrew Dewhurst, made with the real stories and voices from our community. And for that, we thank you. For more information on anything you've heard on today's show, or for direction on where to seek further advice or assistance, visit our Facebook page, Take It From Us. Thank you.